This is a session on Buddhism, which this time I announced as the religion of no God. And I hope before the end of the hour that I'll make some clarity out of that for you. I am Ed Senni, and I am from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach in the theology department at Valparaiso University, which is a Lutheran university of approximately 4,000. And people here in the Northwest often don't know about us. They only know about PLU. But that's where I'm from. And I've been here for almost 3 weeks now. I'm leaving tomorrow. And I've been discussing religions of the world, the main, what we generally call the world religions, the first week and this week. But in between, I did five sessions last week on Native American spirituality. Now, if that you missed something you really were interested in there, the tape library might be of use to you there. As we begin to talk about Buddhism, we need to get it located in space. And for that purpose, I have a somewhat too small map here, but it will remind you at least of both parts of the world where Buddhist influence is very strong. Buddhism began here in the Ganges River Basin in northeast India. You'll see approximately 500 AD. And it spread for a while throughout India. Meanwhile, missionaries were sent to Sri Lanka, Ceylon, and over here into Southeast Asian countries from Ceylon, as it was called. And then Buddhism began to spread up through Tibet and China. And from China on over into Vietnam, I'm off my map now, as you can see, but on over here into the farthest of East Asia, and Japan eventually, about 550 AD, it came into Japan, and became the popular religion of Japan by that time. It lost ground in India at about 1100 AD. So for close to 1500 years, it was a very powerful influence in India. And I believe that much of later Hinduism, many of its attitudes and practices were shaped by the influence of Buddhism. I do not accept the judgment that some people make that Buddhism is a reformation of Hinduism. Buddhism is to Hinduism what Lutheranism was to Roman Catholicism, or what the Reformation was to Roman Catholicism, I should say. No, I don't think that's true. Rather, I think that both Hinduism and the tradition that became Buddhism were dipping into the same pot of ideas. Some ideas that were already latent there, and they worked them out in somewhat parallel ways, but also significantly different as they unfolded. But locating it in space that way, we should realize that these countries that I've pointed to have been dominated in the shaping of their culture by Buddhism. And so we really cannot understand the history or the culture of any of these Southeast Asian countries, or what's going on right now in the battle between the Tamil-speaking Hindus and the Sinhalese Buddhists in Sri Lanka, those battles right now. We can't understand that unless we have some clues about what Buddhism is. We can't understand what was going on in China and in Japan without some clues about that. So, in space, that's the way it looks. In time, I find that when I talk to people who are fairly likely to have some sort of a biblical chronology going on in their head, it helps to link this up with the time of the life of Buddha to the time of what was going on in the history of Israel. So you see it there if you can read that. Can you read that from the back row? With approximately 500 BCE, we are just after the time of exile and in the time when some of the return to Palestine has already taken place. The time just before Ezra. So while that's going on in the Middle East, over here in India, the pot is stirring a new way with the religion of Buddhism getting its start. If we try to orient ourselves then to Indian developments, Hinduism was just moving into the Ganges River Basin. If I were to get that map up again, we have India here, and I said the northeast is where the Ganges was, and it's really in the northwest where Hinduism was strongest. And only gradually that Hindu culture moving into the center and then down into the Ganges River Basin. But there were not only Hindu influences in the Ganges River Basin. So there are other things that are playing in, especially what is item B there, the movement of wandering ascetics. This was a movement, we know of the names of about 18 spiritual masters who were regarded as having attained a higher state of consciousness, a higher wisdom, an enlightenment of some sort. An enlightenment which would free them from the bondage that holds the rest of us to birth after birth after birth in this world. And they were felt to be those kinds of spiritual leaders. And they went from village to village, and people would leave the household life, make arrangements to leave their families behind and so forth, taking good care of them, but then becoming homeless and beggars, owning nothing, and simply going from village to village with the spiritual master in search of spiritual attainment, spiritual transformation of their own selves, in hope that they might come into total communion with whatever that is, which is the ultimate reality, that which we call God. But they wouldn't, because that has connotations that are hard for them to handle. So there were many of those kinds of groups around, and they were doing things a little differently from the way the Hindus were doing things who were coming in. For instance, the wandering ascetics did not accept the caste system as a sacred structure of human society. They rejected it, in fact. They did not accept the honored sacred scriptures of Hinduism. They, in fact, to become one of these wandering ascetics, you had to go through a little ordination rite in order to start following this spiritual master. In order to be justifiably leave society and your responsibilities there, you had to show this. And you had to take a vow to renounce the sacred scriptures of Hinduism. Not that they contain no truth, but you were not to put your trust in them. It's easy to put your trust in a book that you consider to be infallible somehow. But in this business, it was important not to trust a book, but to have an experience, a transforming inner experience. And so, as long as you were trusting something else, you weren't likely to have that experience. So you had to take a different kind of attitude toward those things. Now, so some of the things that were going on in India at that time. Hinduism is well developed, is moving into this region, and it is picking up on some of the same ideas that Buddhism, that the wandering ascetics are picking up on. Axioms of Indian thought at this time, before Buddha. Accepted by all the teachers of the wandering ascetics, accepted by Hinduism. That there is a transmigration of the soul. that the self, the true self, is a divine self. Within each of us, there is the divine self emanating out from one divine source. And that self is linked to this body now, but when this body dies, that soul leaves that body and will come back to birth again and again and again and again. This is the cycle of birth and death, the cycle of samsara. Didn't put that word up there, yeah? Samsara. So you're born, you live your lifespan, you die, something in between perhaps, I won't go into those details, then comes the rebirth, and you go around again, and what's your experience each time? Limitation. Pain, suffering, limitation, spatial limitation, mind limitation, body limitation, degeneration of body, old age, disease, death, and as if going around once weren't tough enough with all that suffering, you have to do it again and again and again and again and again and again. In a sense, a timeless rebirth cycle. That view, as the ordinary state of things, was widely accepted in India at this time. Hindus, wandering ascetic groups, and we will see also Buddhism. And there was a law of the universe which governed that process, and it is called the law of karma. You've read in books the references to karma. His karma must be bad. Well, that means that deeds, karma is deeds, actions. Actions done somewhere along the line are bringing about these consequences in my life today. So the way you behave as a young person has had a certain influence on what's happening to you in your life now. The way you think yesterday is having some influence on your state of health and your state of mind and your state of enjoyment today. And what happened a few minutes ago is having its consequence. We know, we all believe in the law of karma then, don't we? What we think, what we do, has consequences, always. Right? No problem with that, except that in India, it was also assumed that death does not bring that process to a close. And so, as I die, there are many of my deeds of an hour ago, of a day ago, of a week ago, of a year ago, that still have not really come to complete fruition. As though each of those deeds were, some more serious than others, like seeds being planted, and their consequences I have not yet fully reaped. So there are unreaped consequences, leftover karma, to use a kind of a slang way of putting it, and the soul carries that on. And since there is a universal law, just as universal as the law of gravity for us, that deeds must have their consequences, so the soul must come back to birth again in order to reap the consequences of those unrealized deeds. And when you come back to reap the consequences, your life and the conditions of your life now are due not to the whimsy of some god, but they are due to the bed you made with your previous deeds. You made your bed, you lie in it. And that is the way your conditions of life may be explained. And so to do what is right, if we could, we'll get to that kind of definition yet, is to build good karma for better lifetimes in the future. To fail to live according to rightness would be to build bad karma so that in future lifetimes things are worse and worse and worse rather than better and better and better. And there is a kind of coming together here of the spiritual destinies and the material destinies. So in general, one's place in the culture, one's opportunities, the opportunities of my family in which I'm born, and that means economics and educational influence, and all of those things are a kind of sign of, if they're good, a better karma in previous lifetimes, leading to this better opportunity, which if I make the best of that, things get better yet, until finally, a kind of release, liberation, moksha, total enlightenment, which brings to an end this stream of karma and brings to an end this cycle of birth and death. Until one is no longer born in this cycle, but is beyond it, is free, totally free, spirit only. Now, variations on that theme, transmigration, a law, a cosmic law that governs that process. I always use with my students the example of law of gravity, just to make sure they don't get the idea that there's some God up there saying, hey, you did it, you're going to get it. There's no God up there saying that. That's not what law of karma is. It's not some God's law. It's the law that is somehow built into the structures of the universe, like the law of gravity, for as we understand that. And there's nobody mad at me if I jump off the roof and it splats me down below. I mean, it's just the way it is. Built into things. So the processes of rebirth are that way too. So the soul has a kind of evolution from lower forms of spirituality toward more and more goodness, more and more knowledge is possible. It doesn't have to go that way. It can always reverse itself too with bad karma. But you can have a kind of evolution of the soul until finally there is a release. Now, I'm not yet talking about Buddhism. I'm talking about common ground that Buddhism is going to have with the wandering ascetics and with Hinduism. And in India in general, it is just as taken for granted and unquestioned that there is rebirth, that things are cyclical, that the life goes, it's just as taken for granted as it is in our society that it starts here, it ends here. And if you're a believer, and after this, the judgment. It's just as taken for granted. From their point of view, it's more provable because everything else in the universe goes that way. Everything is cyclical. Start with the simplest example of the moon and the seasons and the plant life and the animal life, always. It is coming and going, and humans coming and going. So it seems perfectly obvious. It's one of those things that unless somebody raises the question, it doesn't even occur to you. Well, of course that's the way it is. Just like the opposite of it occurs to us as, of course that's the way it is. You're born, die, and then maybe something else. Now comes the beginning of the life of the one who will be called the Buddha. Under C, at the end, you already see his name, A, B, C, Siddhartha Gautama of the Shakya clan. The life of the Buddha has to begin for the believers. Remember, all lives, stories of the lives of religious founders are stories created by the believers for the believers. Because as an act of faith and praise. And so they are. They have some similarities. One similarity is that there usually are some supernatural manifestations, some things that we don't think happen every day. And so you'll find that in the story of the life of the Buddha too. Well, to talk about the one who's going to become the Buddha, the enlightened one, you have to first tell all the stories of his previous lives. Which I summarize simply by saying, through eons and eons, he had been working away at this quest for the ultimate truth, for the ultimate experience of enlightenment. And goodness, good karma had resulted, and he had evolved into a higher and higher form of being, I guess you could say. So much so that his accumulation of good karma brought him to a state where he was born in a certain heavenly realm, and there were many heavenly realms. In the 10th heaven, the Tushita heaven, and those beings who were born in the Tushita heaven were those who had become so spiritually transformed already that they would need only one more earthly birth to attain perfect enlightenment, perfect union with the ultimate reality. And so he was in that heavenly realm, and persons, beings in that heavenly realm were even able to choose the conditions. They were so close to having completely defeated their karma that they were able to choose their last earthly birth, the conditions of their last earthly birth. And so he chose to be born of Queen Mother Maya, which happens to mean illusion, and the king Suddhodana, who was king really over a very small little kingdom. There were just a whole bunch of little kingdoms struggling with each other, like tribal warfare almost in those days. But nonetheless, the title of Raja was his. So the queen and king. He was born he was conceived in a supernatural way as in the dream of his mother. While she took a nap one afternoon, some gods came down from heaven and picked up her couch on which she was resting and paraded it around in the manner that you would parade around the images of deities in India. And then there came down out of the clouds a white elephant. And the white elephant was a symbol of royalty and a symbol of fertility, since kings had a lot to do with the fertility of the land and all of that. In those times. So this white elephant came down with a symbol of purity, the lotus blossom in its trunk, made a circle around her, which is an act of worship, circumambulation, circling that object of your worship, and then touched her right side. And that was the moment of conception. So we have the miraculous conception of this one who will be the Buddha. After the 9 months, when it was time for the birth, she made a journey she was on her way to her home village, because it was required that the firstborn child of every marriage was to be born in the home village of the mother. So queen or not, she was headed home to bear her first child, accompanied, of course, by her royal attendants. And as she stopped to rest in a garden called Lumbini Garden, not too far from the castle, she paused, took hold of the lower branch of the tree, and there we are told the child was born immediately. But the child was not born with labor, nor through the birth canal, but the child came forth from her side as the conception had occurred, so the birth, a kind of miraculous cesarean. The point of that in the story, is that Buddhism came to hold as one of its highest doctrines the doctrine of non-harming, causing no pain to any sentient being, to any living being. And that's a high ideal within Buddhism. So when the story goes about the Buddha, what they mean by this is already in his birth, he spared his mother every kind of pain. And it's just simply for the believers, it is an example of what they ought to be in caring about causing no pain to any living being, any sentient being. So we have somewhat a miraculous conception and birth, and at the time of the birth there was a great earthquake and flower petals came down out of the skies, and the earth spoke, and a certain tree sprouted out of the tree, big, and all kinds of cosmic manifestations, we like to call them miracles, occurred accompanying that birth. That's the way the stories read, and we have parallels to that in stories we know about crucifixion, and 3 hours of darkness, and star over Bethlehem, and things that seem way out of the ordinary, cosmic manifestations to accompany a great spiritual moment. The father then, when he had accepted the child as his heir, took this little child and had his destiny read. And that was the custom, to go to a certain kind of diviner who would read the destiny of the child, using astrology, genealogy, and all sorts of other techniques that were standardized, and he was a qualified practitioner, and so he read. He examined the body of the child, he examined the time of the astrological times of conception and birth and this and that and of the lineage and all that, and came finally to say, the child will be great in one of two ways. He will either become a universal monarch. His dad was king over nothing more than a little tribe. He liked to call it a kingdom. But must have felt pretty good that your son might become a universal king, king of the world, or become a universal spiritual master and savior. And what shall determine which of those two destinies he has? The answer of the diviner was, the four passing sights will determine. The four passing sights, D up here, you can read the small print, old age, disease, death, ascetic monk. That is, the diviner was saying, if the child is prevented from seeing old age, and disease, and death, and one of those wandering ascetic monks who is sort of in this world but kind of beyond it at the same time, victorious, spiritually victorious over the sufferings of life. But you see, the first three are signs of suffering, old age, disease, and death. And he goes, if he sees these sights, he will abandon the life of luxury, abandon his future as a prince, as a king, and will turn the way of the spiritual recluses. But if he does not see those, he will then become a world monarch. So his father did everything possible to keep him from seeing any such things as old age, disease, and death. Till we finally have him at age 29, and he has been prevented. But in one of the heavens, there are a bunch of gods who understand all this, and they saw that this almost perfected being was about to go to waste instead of to bring the world a new spiritual moment of enlightenment. And these gods then took hold of the matter and became one day an old man along the road. And as the carriage went along and they thought everything was clear and he would see no more than he ever had, all of a sudden there appeared along the roadside a decrepit old man. And he asked his driver, "What is this?" And his driver says, "This is the decrepitude of old age." Is this inevitable that all human beings are born to that destiny? If they should live so long, it is the destiny of all, he was told. And he went home and grieved about that, and he meditated upon the meaning of this destiny of decrepitude, which was all around, of course, in that day especially. And then the next day it was a diseased man, and the same cycle, and then a death, seeing some people carrying their loved ones to the cremation grounds. And he grieves about these things, that humanity is destined to this kind of thing. And then on a fourth occasion, the god showed himself as in the form of a serene monk, one of those wandering ascetics, who in spite of the sufferings of life, in spite of this, seemed to have about him a sense of strength and victory and inner peace fear was completely absent, and that became a signal to him. The first three are a signal of the problem, and the fourth one is a signal that it can be overcome. And so he makes his departure. And there are beautiful stories about the departure. He makes his departure from his royal career, goes out and identifies himself as a wandering ascetic monk, finds himself a spiritual master, tries everything he can, learns everything the spiritual master knows how to teach him, and the master says, "Indeed, you are so quickly an enlightened one, a perfectly enlightened one." And he says, "No, this is not yet the perfect enlightenment. This is not the full truth about reality." And so he goes to another one and has the same kind of experience. He goes to a third one, which is one who taught actually a kind of doctrine that said the more you punish the body, the more the soul will be purified of karma, and that way you will be come to higher spiritual attainment. He tried that with all his might till he almost died of extreme fasting. And then he turned away from that. And Buddhists say he turned to the middle way. There is the self-indulgence of his princely life on the one end. There is this silly self-mortification, this punishment of the body as though that is going to aid the soul on the other extreme. But the middle way is the way of moderation. And that is one of the names for the Buddhist religion. The middle way. The middle path. Moderation. Discipline. Care, but not hate for the body and self-punishment. All right. And so he then, having turned away from that to the middle way, he was on his own, and he eventually came to enlightenment. And he went through a night, the great night of enlightenment is told in detail. It'd be fun to tell all the stories, but the great Buddhist tempter Mara sent his beautiful daughters to tempt him back into the life of the senses, and then the devil sent a rainstorm, and with it great boulders coming down out of heaven, and he had an invisible shield that he was able to create through the power of his meditation over him, and the stones simply fell to the side, and numerous other temptations through the night, and he came through the hour of great temptation victorious and obedient to his plan and to his enlightenment, and became a completely enlightened one. He taught that message. He stayed there for a long time and worked out the how can you talk about this experience? You've got to somehow get some words that will teach the meaning of what he had accomplished. And so in the next 49 days, they would say, he began to take this nonverbal experience and to make it verbal so that he could teach it to others. And then he began his ministry for 40 years, age 35 when he was enlightened, age 80, I believe it was, when he died. And during that time, he gathered a large band of disciples, taught them like other spiritual masters of the wandering ascetics. Only difference is his wandering ascetic group finally became a great world religion. One other one survived, the Jains, or Jainism. Jainism, it's called both of those in India, which is still in India and only in India. That's survived. But Buddhism has become the great world religion out of all those wandering ascetic groups. So he began then as such a spiritual master. The title, the Buddha, simply means the one who is now totally awake to what is. That's tough. That's rare that anybody is totally awake to what is. And that's what his title means for him, the Buddha. Now, let's move into some of the fundamental teachings that he shared after this kind of an experience. The Four Noble Truths are, by all means, the foundation of all of Buddhism. He taught like a physician that all life, all existence is permeated with suffering. There is, even in the midst of our good times, in the midst of our joys, the seeds of suffering are there. The Pali word that is used for suffering, that's translated as suffering here, actually means unsatisfactoriness. That is, there is deep within the human heart a sense that something is unfulfilled, something is not quite satisfied, and yet we will try every program in the book to satisfy it. Let's get rich. Let's try sensuality. Let's try this. Let's try this. Let's try the ego trips. Let's do anything that the world and its cultures offer. But there remains, even in the midst of all of that, a certain kind of deep awareness of unsatisfactoriness, and it keeps driving us to do some more, get some more, try some other ways, grab life, all the gusto you can get. Maybe that'll satisfy. So that's what it means. It doesn't, in other words, mean that every moment of our life we're miserable. But it means that even when we're not miserable, there is a gnawing sense of unsatisfactoriness which motivates us toward our life plan, carries us through our life. Some of you may have heard of the work of Ernst Becker in the last decade here, who writes about death, and he made some suggestions that it is the fear of death which is the energy for living life. And all of life plans come out of that. We're gonna beat this thing by becoming something. But we never beat it. Well, that's what he's saying, really, is that there is deep within that sense, it's not all right. And the cause of that is that we desire. We desire. I want. I want. I want. And I never have. And I want more if I have it. And if I get it, I want to keep it. And I know I can't keep it. It's going to slip through my fingers. I want, I want, I want, I want endless. That is the name of being human. I want it to be this way instead of this way. I want pleasure instead of pain. Long life instead of short. I want, I want. And that, he says, is the cause of this unsatisfactoriness. Because we desire, there is this gnawing sense of unsatisfaction. We must then rid ourselves of that desire in order to escape the suffering. And then number 4 says, and there is a plan for doing it. He wouldn't have been the Buddha if he hadn't been able to propose now how it is that even as he came through that suffering to victory and enlightenment, so also there is a way that we might do so, because he did so as a human being. He was not a god in human flesh. He was a human being who did it in many lifetimes, to be sure. But he did it. And he shows the way, then, the eightfold path for overcoming that whole problem. It is the eightfold path of right views, right aims, right speech, right behavior. All these things, the last 3 of them focus on mental practices. That is, meditational things. Right mental effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, from there, we have to go at, now how are we going to overcome that desire which causes the suffering, the unsatisfactory, the feeling of unsatisfactoriness? And the doctrine in which Buddhism deals with that is called the no-self doctrine. In short, for this 1-hour zip-through job, I'm going to try to make sense for you by saying, to get rid of the I want, the desire, that would do it, wouldn't it? according to the proposal of the Four Noble Truths. If there were no desire, there would be no unsatisfactoriness, no suffering. How do you get rid of desire? The Buddha says, by getting rid of the notion of self. And, you know, this self that was born in such and such a year, in such a place, in such and such a family, had such and such experiences, comes now to believe such and such a things, knows these things, does this. This self, that's the ego in it. That's the biographical self, which I'll do anything to defend. I'll talk nasty about other people to defend it. I'll do whatever I can to try to enhance that self, because that's the self we naturally know. And he says, of course, that's an illusion. There is no such self. Oh, but then the wise one comes from Hinduism and says, ah, that is true, my master. There is no such self like that. That's an illusion that we create. But there is a true self, the Atman, the spiritual self, the divine self. And if we could fasten onto that, then we would not have desire. He says, I do not know that there is such a self. I cannot prove that there is such a self. So even to assume that kind of permanent spiritual divine selfhood, he says, is to be trapped into the I want. So he says, in order to get rid of the I want, you must get rid of the I am. If there is no self, what then is there? There is only the eternal process of everything coming into being and going out. He wants to strip us of anything that we're going to grab a hold of and cling to and therefore want. We'll fasten our desire on. Someone proposes from Hinduism again, how about the one eternal Brahman, the eternal divine reality? God. I do not know that there is an eternal creator, an eternal ruler of the universe. For that we can argue about, and some argue that it is, and some argue that it isn't. Obviously there is something ultimate, but to name it like that, to identify it, and then to grab hold of that. What for? In order to want something. And the process is still there. So he strips that away. And that's what I meant by my title, of saying Buddhism, the religion of no God. Now, he's saying then that there is nothing permanent. That's really what he's trying to say. There is nothing permanent. There is no rock of ages. That kind of notion of God. There is no ruling God. There is no. And yet there is a process, isn't there, of creativity, of life, and of compassion. There's some kind of a process like that there. But it cannot be identified and it cannot be named. So he strips away the concept of self, strips away the concept of such a God, and then shows them how to let go. When you let go of all that, it is as though you are about to have nothing. And my shortcut through this is to say, and when you let go thinking you have nothing, you are upheld. You are upheld. When you stop fighting it. It's like, I guess, some swimming lessons. When people fight it and fight it and fight it and they're about to go down. And if they finally learn how to stop fighting it, it upholds them. And that's really what he's getting at. Buddhism does not mean to say that there is nothing ultimate in the universe, but that which is the ultimate is, in a sense, in all things and behind all things. It is the fountain of the whole process which we call this world. It is something that you cannot get hold of, you cannot define, and as soon as you do anything more than point at it and grunt toward it, you have made an idol of it, you have limited it. But to let go of all the craving and of all the wanting I want myself to go to heaven. That Buddhism says, that shows where you are. It's that self and the want that you have built around that self. So Buddhism, when we talk to them in dialogue as Christians, when we talk to knowledgeable ones in particular, we start talking about this matter. Well, what we say God, and we say some things about God, and we understand that God is beyond our description and some of this. And they say, well, you know, I say, well, what kind of God is it you're rejecting? I mean, I always want to know that when someone says, I don't believe in God. I want to know, what kind of God don't you believe in? Because I may join you. Because I don't believe in the kind of God that a lot of people talk about. I don't believe in a God that you put your little prayer coins in like a slot machine to get your way. and a lot of things like that. So what they will regularly say is a personal being who is source and king of the universe. Ruler of the universe. That's called theism in my studies. Theistic religion. And if it's only one, it's called monotheism. It's God having personal qualities and therefore deserving and receiving personal pronouns. He, she. Gotta be careful. He, she. The pronouns that suggest that, like we are persons, somehow the heart of that ultimate reality is also person. But Buddhism wants to say that's too limiting. That's too limiting for God. And it sends us on a false track if we start talking like that. We refuse that. But yet there is something. And then they come up with a number of different concepts like nirvana and karma and Buddha and dharma. And somehow when I put all those different really big concepts together into one package, I think they got something very much like what I understand to be God. So it's a little bit tricky. Somewhere along the line, you'll read something that says Buddhism doesn't believe in God. And maybe this gives you just a little clue, at least, as to in what ways that might be true and what ways that is not true. Now, nirvana is the ultimate release. When one is enlightened and therefore breaks out of this cycle, no more to be born again, no more suffering the penalty of bad karma in previous lifetimes and so forth. That is nirvana. And of course, it's a state that is beyond human language and beyond human knowing. If I said it is existence, there is an existence in that nirvana state, then that word existence already has an opposite, doesn't it? Non-existence. And so the thought polarity, does he exist or does he not exist? Does the Buddha exist after he died? Or does he not exist after he died? And the Buddhist teaching says, the question already suggests our limitation. For he is beyond description, beyond the state of either existence or non-existence. Oneness beyond these opposites. Is that heaven? Well, you know, not like we would understand it, because first of all, there isn't a personal being to hold you in his arms and to wipe your tears away and all that other lovely images that mean a lot to us in our personal devotion to God. It isn't exactly a heaven. It is impossible to say what it is, but they have no doubt, but what it is, the highest possible good for which human beings could hope, dream. It is what creation itself intended human beings to come to finally. They have no doubt about that. it is the highest state. So no matter what they reject, there is an affirmation inside of it still. The one more thing that I still have time to say in this, I guess, is that Buddha is not a god. Now, if you've traveled in those parts of the country, you probably feel like challenging what I just said, because you see people going to these Buddha images and praying and putting flowers around them and bringing all these offerings, and it seems like they're praying. But officially and technically and orthodox, no. The Buddha was a man who attained what all human beings can possibly attain through many lifetimes of spiritual transformation to this state of nirvana. He was the one who showed the way and gave us the path. It does not exist somewhere to answer our prayers. And then come some variations. And the variations that we would see if we would unfold major divisions in Buddhism, Theravada and Mahayana, would be ways in which, in spite of saying what I've just said, they would say, still somehow that Buddha energy that was there in him just can't have come and gone. It had to be from before, and it has to be somewhere, somehow available still. And through some very surprising ways that, from our standpoint, they are still feel themselves in certain forms of Buddhism then able to get hold of some of that perfecting energy, that Buddha energy, which is in certain sense available everywhere as the sacred power and source of the life that's all around us and is possible for us. Now, it's tough to call this a religion of grace sometimes, since that's a nice category that we Christians love very much, and we like to straighten the whole world out by that category and say, well, you know, there's grace in Christianity, but all the rest are working real hard at it. We don't have to work hard at it. And that's not quite true, because as I suggested, it may look like work your way, work your way, work your way, work your way, but you know what the big secret is at the end? That you can't. And that when you let go of it all and stop grabbing, you are upheld. And behind Buddhism, that's what I find. I don't find it everywhere. I just find that in certain very high expressions of it and manifestations of it, you're getting to that again. Then there is one form of Buddhism that just talks like it came straight out of Wittenberg, talking grace. I don't mean Wittenberg University. I mean the Reformation University. And it talks about salvation is entirely by the power of that heavenly being, not by any merit on our part at all. And by trusting, calling upon the name of that being, a certain kind of heavenly being that I don't dare name because I'd have to explain it, we are saved by grace through faith without merit. And there's that happens in a certain form of Buddhism too. That's really all the time I have. Let's take a couple minutes here for some questions, and then I know we're going to get crowded right out of here for Vespers. Yes?
I think it was the Four Noble Truths that you referenced to evil. Is evil synonymous with bad karma or desire?
The Fourth Noble Truth says that suffering can be overcome by following the Noble Eightfold Path.
Well, it has some reference to evil. How do they see evil?
Well, okay. Moral evil, you mean. What is bad karma, in other words? What are you sinning against? You're sinning against the built-in laws of the universe. By, for instance, look at the five precepts, by taking life, by killing, you're sinning against the structures of reality by taking what is not a gift. from the world, from other people. You violate something when you take what is not good. To illicit sexual behaviors, the disorders. You create disorders within the human community. False and twisted speech, you enhance this ego self at someone else's expense all the time. And intoxication, which fuzzies up the mind and you can't get clarity about the truth of life when you're doing that. Now those are just little hints about there is a kind of structure of morality built into things. It's not dictated by some being, but it's there in things. And when you go against that, you create bad karma. When you live in harmony with that, you create good karma and evolve toward enlightenment. 30,000 lifetimes away, maybe, but nevertheless, you're moving, transforming. Well, that's not the whole story. Yes? Were you about to say, someone about to ask a question? We probably better adjourn it to clear the hall for that. I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards or after Vespers. Thank you very much.